Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
Rick, here we are. A lot of news. The president has been doing a lot of talking over the last 24 hours, and we're going to kind of go through, I think, even by this president's standards, some rather, shall we say, unusual. But first of all, can we pick it up where we left off the last Powerhouse Politics?
Please.
Were talking about Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And I think I was telling you that I thought there was a real chance he might not actually run. You were insisting, no, he's going to win, he's going to all this stuff. So since then, we've had a whole series of allegations come out about Joe Biden, beginning with Lucy Flores telling the story of when she, you know, she had Biden out to campaign for her in Nevada, mm-hmm. You know, the kind of creepy smelling of the hair, kissing her on the back of the head, all that kind of stuff. Now there's quite a bit out there right now. What's this going to do to Biden?
There is nothing that has come out that shouldn't have been entirely anticipated by Joe Biden's team. And the fact that it wasn't suggests that he doesn't actually have much of a campaign team in the first place. I think that's item one takeaway.
How about the rapid response, though?
It has not been rapid, and it has not been responsive. Mm. And that, to me, is another tell about not having a fully formed team ready to go. And Biden has done this before. He's put together kind of a ragtag group of advisors, but they should have been prepared for this. And they need to be prepared for how different this era is and how 45 years' worth of interactions with Joe Biden, who is a hands-on politician. He calls himself a tactile politician. Those interactions look different in the light of 2019, and he is coming into very much a realization of that, and he has been relatively silent this week except for
relatively.
A couple of statements. Yeah, some statements. He hasn't said anything on camera.
I mean, he put out written statements in response to the Lucy Flores allegations Friday over the weekend, I think, were the two, right? Am I correct about
that's
this?
That's right, yeah.
We've heard some from some Biden spokesperson, but from Biden himself, and we haven't actually seen him in public talk about this. What day is it?
Today's Wednesday, April 3rd.
Okay, so this is an eternity
5-day-old story
in political time.
That's right.
And we have not heard from Biden directly. Nancy Pelosi, we've heard from. Nancy Pelosi has come out to say she doesn't think this is disqualifying, but that Biden's answers on this are not enough. And still nothing.
That's still nothing.
Still nothing.
And people I've talked to in other campaigns have said this just is an example of a guy that is not running a campaign for 2019. The fundraising numbers that have come out this week are another reason that he may be delaying his announcement for a couple of weeks. But they have to get in front of this if he is going to run for president. And I still think he is much more likely than not to announce his candidacy. There it is on the record, John, for future trash talking purposes.
Yeah.
This is going to be a big part of the initial launch of the coverage, unless or until they get out in front and start answering questions about it, because we're only seeing more people come forward. And we should make a stark line between this and the Me Too allegations that have felled other politicians, or in the case of Donald Trump, have not felled.
Well, this is a perfect issue for Donald Trump to take advantage of, right, given his background.
So clean as a whistle on anything like this.
So let's talk about that, because I would have thought that if there was a little self-awareness, you know, this might be the kind of thing that Trump might not want to
What do you do for ABC News again? You're the White House correspondent?
It's okay. Yeah, because I don't know if you remember this, but there were a whole series of allegations against Donald Trump during the campaign and some quite serious, all of them quite serious, but some of them, could venture into criminal behavior.
Yeah.
The president, of course, denied those allegations, but there were a lot of very serious allegations against Donald Trump, and of course there were his own words on tape and the mm-hmm. Access Hollywood. So anyway, he actually directly addressed this at a fundraiser last night for House Republicans, and He basically made a joke. Welcome, you know, how do you like the world, Joe Biden? And then he told this little story about meeting a general named General Kane. Listen to this.
I said, what's your name, Raisin? What's your last name? Kane. I said, you mean your name's Raisin Kane? Yes, sir. That's the guy that told me. I said, so? My people tell me 2 years. What do you think? 1 week, sir. I said, General, come here. Give me a kiss. I felt like Joe Biden.
Well, I don't know.
Rimshot. I mean, it's this late night comic president.
I'm just not
spikes
sure.
Again.
I'm not sure this is the issue. That anyway. But let's pivot to the president, because as I mentioned at the top, to be very serious, he's been saying some, and you know he always kind of surprises us,
yeah.
Right? You know, he was talking about the Mueller report. Did you hear about this? And this was in the Oval Office on Tuesday. And I don't know. I'm just going to play what he said.
There was no collusion. There was no obstruction. They were very disappointed. I don't know what they were thinking, because they all know. I guarantee you they go into a room between Nadler, Schiff, and the group, and they laugh like hell at how they've kept this thing going for 2 years. They laugh like hell. And I hope that this investigation now, which is finished, it's totally finished. No collusion, no obstruction. I hope they now go and take a look at the oranges of the investigation, the beginnings of that investigation.
Okay, so the oranges. I mean, he meant to say origins, but he said it a couple more times, and then he repeated himself like three times about these oranges of the investigation.
How Florida of him.
Okay,
yes.
Whatever. It's fine. But then there was this kind of odd statement about his father, Fred Trump.
I always talk about Germany. I mean, Germany, honestly, is not paying their fair share. I have great respect for Angela, and I have great respect for the country. My father is German, right? Was German. And born in a very wonderful place in Germany. So I have a great feeling for Germany.
A very wonderful place in Germany that's called the Bronx.
Yeah, I think that's about right. This is a strange. He has said it before, and No one can figure out why he said it ever.
He had a grandfather was born in Germany.
Is he trying to birther himself? Is that possible?
I don't know. But I just want to keep along this line. He gave this speech last night, as I mentioned, for the House Republicans fundraiser, big event. And, well, he seemed to be worried that the speech might leak.
I don't want to use names because I'll get in trouble, because it's always somebody's going to leak this whole damn speech to the media, to the fake news.
You know, and somebody did leak the speech. You know why?
Why?
Because C-SPAN was broadcasting it live.
Oh my
because
God.
There was a White House pool camera there, NBC News, because the place was filled with reporters. That's why it leaked.
Because it was an open
press
event?
Because it was on the record. Because it was an open thing, and there were lights all over. Anyway, that was a little strange. But can I do, you don't mind?
Please, no, please. March along.
Then he got in this, you know, he likes coal. We know that he likes coal. He's not a big alternate energy kind of guy, and he doesn't seem to like wind very much, wind power. But anyway, play it.
If you have a windmill anywhere near your house, congratulations. Your house just went down 75% in value. And they say the noise causes cancer. You tell me that one, okay? You know, the thing makes it so. And of course, it's like a graveyard for birds. If you love birds, you'd never want to walk under a windmill, because it's a very sad, sad sight. It's like a cemetery. We put a little statue for the poor birds.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, windmills do kill a lot of birds, but I never heard the noise causing cancer stuff. Or anyway, these are maybe trivial things. This is Trump being Trump. But there are some more substantive things that have been rather strange over the last few days. I don't know, you know, I mean, he said he was going to close the – remember he said he was going to close the Mexican border?
Yeah, he was definitely going to do it, right? And Mick Mulvaney told you over the weekend that unless something incredibly dramatic happens, it's happening this week.
And last night he was speaking about – how, speaking about in the past tense, about how he wanted to close the border. But now Mexico, they're, did you see, they just detained 1,000 people at the border yesterday. And he makes it sound like because he made this threat, Mexico has entirely changed their position and is now suddenly stopping the migrants on the Mexican side of the border. ABC News, we've gone, we've contacted Department of Homeland Security. We've got our man Matt Gutman on the border. We've been looking for evidence of any change in the posture of the Mexicans, who, of course, had long ago promised that they would cooperate on this and process asylum cases, allow them to be processed on their side of the border. But we can find no evidence of any change whatsoever in what the Mexicans are doing. But now the president, at least last night, and maybe he'll change again today, I don't know.
And what about health care, John? About health care? So the president has reversed course on this policy position, and he's created chaos throughout his entire administration. We remember just a week ago his administration announced that they were joining the Obamacare lawsuit, and that they wanted it all to be tossed out, and of course,
and completely terminated,
which
was a change in the policy. Yes.
And that means the Republicans would have a plan. They would have a plan, and
well,
they
said they were
going to
be the party of
healthcare. Yeah. You watch.
And he sent our friend Mark Short, friend of the podcast, chief of staff for the vice president now, went on television and said that they would be introducing their Republican health care plan. It would be forthright. And then he reversed again. He seemed to say – well, he did say in a tweet and then reiterated it in the same Oval Office event that the Republican health care plan would wait until after the election, after he wins re-election – after the Senate remains in Republican hands and after Republicans win back the House, so they would do it after the election. I don't know. But last night he was back talking about health care again, and here's what he had to say.
If we stay away from that subject, we're going to lose. We're going to lose. We can't stay away. It's too important. It's too important because the Democrats, you know what? We have the border. We have, if you look at it, we have the immigration, but we have a lot. We have the crime. We have the police. We have the military. We have so much. They have health care right now. We have to take that away from it. We take that away. We take that away. We will not even come close.
I mean, it's I don't know. Diagram that those sentences. but apparently he wants to take health care away from the Democrats.
No. Yeah, and the way you do that is waiting 20 months to vote on a proposal until after the election. You know, we use a phrase all the time, a football metaphor about punting on issues all the time. This is punting on first down. We're 20 months away from the election to say that you're not even going to try to introduce a plan, and it's a secret plan that no one is going to know about until after the election if the Republicans win. If he wins, by the way, it's all predicated on him winning another term, first and foremost. So he's going to run for re-election on a secret health care plan. How do you think Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republican colleagues feel about that one, John?
I don't know. You know, McConnell, I thought this was an extraordinary moment of defiance of a president of your own party. When the president did his riff, and he did it right walking into a meeting with Senate Republicans, elaborated further that they were going to be the party of health care, that they were going to introduce their own alternative, the Republican alternative, be much better than Obamacare. And then Mitch McConnell came out to the cameras and he said, we're not doing it.
Yeah. He originally said, I look forward to what Speaker Pelosi and the president come up with on this, which is a classic Mitch McConnell passive aggressive move. Like, it ain't mine.
And then he said, it's not going to be us. We're not going to be. And then the president suddenly did his about face and said, we'll wait until after the election to vote on this. Maybe he's thinking after Mitch McConnell's. I don't know
whether he's in office or not.
These are serious issues. The threat on the border caused there were discussions, but political. There's a political dynamic. There's a diplomatic dynamic, and then he seems to take it back. And then I don't know. I mean, he seems to be a little. Is it listless since the Barr summary of the Mueller report? Is there any relation? Well, I don't know exactly what's going on.
I feel like there's a couple levels to this. One is, you know, the Borscht Belt presidency that you see on display when he goes out there in front of cameras and is just riffing. And maybe he thought this was there weren't cameras there. Maybe he didn't. But it's not just that. I mean, we're used to the president just saying stuff without any strategy behind it. That's part of what President Trump is. The other thing that I think is more serious for Republicans is, as they start to gear up for 2020, knowing that the president's at the top of the ticket, knowing that they've pledged loyalty to him, to have these incredible contortions on policy positions that they're forced into. What it means for the entire federal government and the Congress to be told that the president is about to shut down the border. You don't just say that. You don't just do that. There's actual economic implications. There's national security implications to all that. And then on issues like health care, where Republicans just don't want to be there, to be led all over the place on this, the president stepping all over his messaging and coming out and declaring that his party is going to have something that, of course, it's not going to have. This is the downside of Donald Trump. And that's what Republicans are finding out now and going to find out over these next months, unless or until there's some discipline imposed on this. This is all over the place.
Well, I wouldn't predict discipline, but I also, this is coming after Barr has announced principal findings. The most important principal finding arguably is that after 22 months, Mueller finds no collusion between the Trump campaign or the president and the Russians. I still have a lot of questions about other aspects of the end of Mueller, of what's going to happen now as we await the release of the report, and what the heck is going on with the other investigations, perhaps most importantly, the investigation done out of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. And I think I have found the perfect guy to help us understand these issues, somebody who actually was the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, very prominent former prosecutor, out with a new book. I think we got to talk to him.
Let's do it. Let's go to a break and bring him in. What do you think?
And when we come back, Preet Bharara. All right. And joining us now is the former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Mr. Preet Bharara. Thank you for joining us, Preet.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So you're out with a new book, Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. And, you know, this may not surprise you, but I want to get some of your thoughts about the current state of some of those issues regarding the president of the United States.
No, you do?
Yes.
Nobody ever asks about that.
Can we remind everybody that you actually you kind of worked under President Trump for a glorious how many days?
It was like 7 weeks.
7 weeks?
Trump administration veteran.
Trump administration veteran.
That's like six Scaramucci's.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's incredible. So we've been trying to figure out what to expect now, along with everybody else. Barr has given us his principal findings from the Mueller report. I saw you, unlike others who seemed to have a hard time accepting much of what Barr said. There's the stark conclusion, maybe the central conclusion: no conspiracy between the Trump campaign and the Russians. But obviously,
that's an important distinction, obviously, right? People keep getting upset about it, and in some cases, rightly so. The president keeps talking about collusion. His supporters keep talking about collusion. Collusion is a lay term that doesn't mean anything legally, and the special counsel didn't make any finding about what, you know, evidence there was of collusion or not, the sort of generic term that means was there, you know, some, relationship with or acceptance of benefits from the Russians in connection with the campaign. And they only focused on conspiracy. And that's why, and the reason that's important is that Adam Schiff, the chief, the chairman of the Intel Committee in the House, is getting a lot of grief from the minority members, I think unfairly, because Adam Schiff has talked about collusion as well, this generic term, for which there is plenty of evidence. Bob Mueller only made a decision about whether or not there was enough evidence to make a criminal case of conspiracy. So I just want to point that out.
But when Adam Schiff is talking about collusion, I mean, what he is talking about, when he is understood to be talking about, is the idea that somehow the Trump campaign was involved in the Russian efforts to interfere with the election, specifically the hack of the DNC emails and the Podesta emails, and the fake news social media campaign. And we've seen no evidence, and there's no suggestion that Mueller has any evidence that there was any involvement on the part of the Trump campaign in that effort.
Well, again, involvement is an odd word, too. Whether there was an agreement or a meeting of the minds in real time on an ongoing basis to do those things. He has said there's not enough evidence to state a crime, which is, I think a little different. But be that as it may, well, I think all of us can understand a little bit better what Mueller and his team found and concluded, and what they didn't find and conclude when we finally see the report.
And I want to ask you about a specific statement from Barr when he talks about this process of getting the Mueller report ready to send to Congress and to release publicly. He's going to take out classified information. He's going to take out grand jury information. But then he mentions information that would disparage third parties.
Peripheral third parties. Which so is another – there's a lot of definitional problems in all of the discussions about the Mueller investigation, collusion, involvement, conspiracy, and now we have peripheral.
So is peripheral would mean – would that mean those who have not been charged? So is the president peripheral?
Well, I assume – you know, no one's been charged, and the people who've been charged, we all know about it. So I think disparaging information about people who have been charged is already available.
Right.
And I don't expect the Mueller report to say a lot more than what is already publicly known about, for example, people like Paul Manafort and Roger Stone. Remember, the report is supposed to outline decisions to prosecute and decisions not to prosecute. And the decisions to prosecute, it seems to me, the documents that have been made public and the trial that happened with respect to Manafort, that all speaks for itself. Now, with the remaining universe of humans, I guess there are peripheral and non-peripheral. And Bill Barr is making a distinction. And by the way, I think that's not necessarily terrible news from the perspective of people who want disclosure. Again, the proof is in the pudding, and a lot of promises have been made by a lot of people over time about transparency, and it doesn't happen. But it doesn't sound like Barr is saying, well, anyone who wasn't charged, even if they were sort of central to the investigation, should have their information redacted. He doesn't seem to be saying that. So that, in other words, if there was an investigation relating to, someone close to the president, and it was a significant part of the investigation, and people have known it was part of the investigation, for example, Donald Jr. or Jared Kushner or some other folks, the implication of his last letter seems to be that some of that information will be revealed. And, to the extent there are other, random people, I don't know if that would include folks like the secretary to the president or other folks. I don't know. Again, he doesn't define peripheral, but people who really had no role in anything and sort of, fell into the orbit of Donald Trump and in the ambit of the investigation, and some, things were found out about them, but they didn't amount to much. We shouldn't be maligning them in a public report. That seems to be what he's saying, but I mean, at this point, to coin a phrase, who the hell knows?
And just today, the House Judiciary Committee voted to authorize subpoena of the Mueller report itself. There's an insistence in Congress to see the whole thing unredacted, at least the chairman and ranking member to have access to that. Do you feel like that's an appropriate step, or are there things that the Congress and the public should never see that could potentially be in that report?
Yeah, so this is going to sound like maybe an odd answer to that. The way you asked the question, is it an appropriate step? I think absolutely yes. That doesn't mean that I necessarily believe at the end of the day that every single word and every single bit of punctuation should be made public, because there might be a good faith reason for certain aspects, hopefully minimal, relating to ongoing investigations or classified material that shouldn't become public. By the way, I think all the classified information should be provided to Congress. Congress is different, and at least the chairs of the relevant committees, Judiciary and Intel, they're different as well. But I do think it's an appropriate step because I think Congress has an independent role as a co-equal branch of government, and it's unclear what Bill Barr is going to do. There's the rhetoric of transparency that's happened over time. The president himself has sometimes lapsed into the rhetoric of transparency, but then it doesn't end up happening. And I think because time is of the essence, sort of generally, because people want answers and a long time has elapsed, to put down in writing and throw the gauntlet down and set in motion, a series of events so that you can frame the issue, if it has to be framed, for a negotiation with the White House and or a litigation in the courts, I think you proceed the way that they're proceeding.
Let's turn to the Southern District, your friends and former colleagues there. We all are depending on what we know about this, based on court filings, based on some public statements of people that we know that have cooperated with investigators in the Southern District. What is your best read of what the scope of what is the investigative work that's going on in the Southern District? What is your sense of what that work is and what the work product would be? Would it just be speaking through indictments, or could there be a report that comes out of the Southern District?
I doubt a report. That's not something that we did. That's the kind of thing a special counsel does. I don't think we ever issued a report ever in the 7.5 years that I ran that place. And I understand that this is a different kind of investigation if it implicates a sitting president. But I still think that's a bridge too far, and it's not the kind of thing that they do. And it's out of the it's very out of the ordinary. So I have two responses. One, I don't have any personal knowledge of what they may be looking at specifically. I see the reports like everyone else. I'm out of the job, and nobody tells me anything. But from the reports, it looks like, number one, they have the view that the president committed a campaign finance violation with Michael Cohen, because they have repeated the assertion of Michael Cohen in open court that he committed that campaign finance violation in connection with the payoffs in coordination with and at the direction of individual one, who's the president. So that, to me, is a very significant thing. Whether they'll act on that now or they'll act on that when the president leaves office, I don't know. And then there are reports of investigative activity relating to the inaugural committee, the Trump Organization, and there's probably a lot of those things going on, and probably a number of things that we don't know about, because the Pandora's box has been opened both by Michael Cohen, who continues to try to cooperate post-conviction. So I don't know. The other thing I will say, though, separate from the particulars of what they're looking at and what I wrote about extensively in the book, is about the character of the place and the characters in that place and the philosophy of the place and the culture of the place and how we went about making decisions, how we decided to go forward, and how we deliberated very carefully. And sometimes we proceeded, and people didn't like it, and some people did like it, and sometimes we didn't proceed, and some people liked that and didn't like that. So at the end of the day, I think it's important for people to understand that in the same way that it wasn't Bob Mueller's job to get the president, it's not the Southern District's job to get the president or to get a bad guy. Their job is to figure out what the truth is, what the evidence is, what's provable in court, and to bring only cases that are in the interest of justice. And they are fearless and aggressive and independent, but they're also fearless and independent in the other direction. And if they don't think there's enough evidence to bring a case against anyone, whether it's someone close to the president or the president himself, notwithstanding the policy of the Justice Department that you can't indict a sitting president, they'll walk away too. And I think that's what you want in fair-minded prosecutors.
Is there an argument that this entire episode and the way the president has gone out and publicly berated prosecutors, has called for the politicization of prosecutions in very specific cases, that throughout all of this, that there is something reassuring about the way justice, the wheels of justice have kept turning, the way Jeff Sessions followed the advice of the ethics lawyers at Justice. He recused himself. Rod Rosenstein has been taking abuse from the president's allies for nearly 2 years. That the investigation went through, it ran its course. There was no, as we can tell, any interference. Barr tells us in his letter that there wasn't anything that Mueller requested that he was denied. Is there something reassuring about the way justice has worked in this case?
Yeah, look, there are examples. You pointed out a number of them. Also, the fact that Rod Rosenstein appointed Mueller in the first place. The reason we're in this situation is because Rod Rosenstein thought there had been a serious breach and concern and lack of faith and worry that there had been obstruction of justice. I mean, that's where all of this began with Bob Mueller. It was in the immediate wake of the firing of Jim Comey and other erratic behavior by the president. There had been other occasions where the president seems to have asked Matt Whitaker and Don McGahn, his former White House counsel, to do things that they refused to do. In another example, although it didn't really amount to much, we're seeing this unfolding of the scandal around national security clearances and high-level clearances in the White House. And, Don McGahn again and the former chief of staff, John Kelly, made it clear on the record for posterity that they didn't think, 25 to 27 people who were deemed not worthy of having security clearances, that they thought they shouldn't get those security clearances. So there have been people who have stood up along the way and caused, Trump to turn back against his worst instincts. So I think that's encouraging. But it is still true that someone with the power and the megaphone of Donald Trump over time, if he is able to accidentally or intentionally, put certain kinds of loyal people in various positions, that the things that we are talking about can be eroded more and there'll be fewer examples of people standing up for what's right and the rule of law rather than bending to the will and to the demand for loyalty from the president.
Of course, the Attorney General announced in his letter a week and a half ago that there would be no prosecution, no pursuit of an obstruction of justice case. We know from what he said of Mueller's report that Mueller doesn't make a recommendation one way or the other. He presents it. It appears evidence on both sides. Does that, though, mean that obstruction of justice as a topic is off the table entirely for the Justice Department? Or could it be that something the Southern District works on leads back the road to obstruction? In other words, would Mueller have exonerated the president or his non-decision leading to Barr's decision to exonerate the president entirely on obstruction, or could it come back in a different investigation?
Yeah, I suppose if there's a different investigation that uncovers different facts and has a different focus, even if it overlaps a little bit, I suppose hypothetically there could be a future case of obstruction. But what I take Bob Mueller to have said is it was left to me to decide this. I couldn't decide it. It was too close a question. So we're not stating that a crime was committed. Also, we're not stating that a crime wasn't committed. The president is not exonerated. Since he had sort of the exclusive power in connection with the investigation to make that determination, I don't think there's anyone else in the Justice Department who is going to sort of rise to the occasion, so to speak, and say, well, we have a different view and we're going to prosecute. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So in some ways, by the way, and this might sound controversial to some ears, It doesn't matter that much that Bill Barr sort of interceded and put his own, helpful spin and gloss on that's different from what Bob Mueller found, his own spin and gloss on whether or not obstruction was committed. Because I don't think once Bob Mueller said, I cannot state whether a crime was committed, it's too close a question. The idea that the Department of Justice was going to charge the president with obstruction was a dead letter. And by the way, it was already a dead letter in any event because of the prevailing policy that you can't indict or prosecute a sitting president. What I think is the same as what a lot of people think, is that Bob Mueller put it in writing, set it out in a document that I think will be fairly eye-opening because all the evidence will be marshaled, even if some of it we've seen before, and that it provides a possibility for action by the co-equal branch of government, to whom was delegated this responsibility of holding a president accountable in certain circumstances of abuse of power or the commission of a high crime and misdemeanor. I'm not prejudging that because I don't know what the report says. But I think, within the department, the issue of obstruction seems to be at an end, although a close question, but not at an end for Congress.
Just quickly, I know you have to go. Do you think Mueller's decision not to make a finding on that was an abdication of his responsibility? I mean, he was appointed to investigate this and take it out of the political, into an independent realm.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's quite right when you're talking. I mean, he was asked to investigate a lot of things. He wasn't asked, hey, can you, build a case against one man, Donald J. Trump, the president of the United States? He was looking at a lot of things. He was looking at Russian interference. He was looking at other things that arose from that investigation, and lots of people fell within his eyesight and in his crosshairs. I think the president is different. And so, with respect to those other people like Roger Stone and Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn and all sorts of others in the GRU in Russia, he's the sole decider of what does or does not happen to them. And if he decides to walk away, then it's over. The president is different from all of those other people in two ways, which we've talked about. One, he has basically a shield against prosecution that he shouldn't be able to wield against folks who want to make sure that the record becomes known as to what his misconduct may have been. And then second, he's subject to accountability through this other process. I don't think the assignment and the appointment of Robert Mueller to investigate this meant that he was supposed to keep away from a co-equal branch of government their role in holding a president potentially accountable. I mean, that's not how it happened in Watergate, as people are looking back and seeing. And it looks like that's not what's happening here either.
Hey, before you go, what's next for you? We've
I got to tape my podcast.
I know. You got
I got that in there.
You got your podcast. It's a phenomenal podcast.
Well, I'm continuing to talk about the book. which is since you didn't mention, I will mention that it debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list.
Congratulations.
Which means everyone should buy it and read it.
And get it to number 1.
And that's why I'm talking to you, fine gentlemen. I hear you move the numbers. So I have a lot of other things going on. I'm working on continuing on this task force with Governor Christy Todd Whitman to sort of make proposals to Congress to shore up democracy in light of all the things that are going on. I'm working on a task force that will make proposals to the Securities and Exchange Commission to reform insider trading laws. And I've got, you know, more writing and teaching to do at NYU Law School. And we'll sort of see when the book sort of business dies down, what other service I can provide.
Could be running for office.
Probably not.
And I saw you. I saw you were hanging out with Mayor Pete backstage at Bill.
Mayor
Maher.
Pete keeps following me, and he came on the podcast, and then I went on Bill Maher's show. Mayor Pete was there. Then I went on Lawrence O'Donnell's show a couple of days ago. Mayor Pete was there, so I don't know.
And what do you think?
I think he's stalking me.
What do you think?
I don't have a pick. I don't have is it a dog or a horse? I don't have any kind of animal in the race or the fight, as they say. But look, I think Mayor Pete is incredibly smart, incredibly refreshing, knows how to speak about things, has deep knowledge of not just 7 languages, but I think a lot of policy. And look, you know, I know he's 37, and he may not make it this time around, but at a minimum, you can say, based on how he's acquitted himself, and I spent a solid hour and 15 minutes sort of in-depth talking to him on my podcast, he is definitely someone we're going to be hearing about and thinking about and listening to for a long time, whether this is his time or not.
No question. All right. The name of the book is Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. Preet Bharara, thank you for joining us on Powerhouse Politics. Get that book to number 1. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, gentlemen. Take care.
Thank you.
Always thoughtful.
Thoughtful, indeed. I think takeaway for me, he has said previously that collusion is dead, obstruction also dead. It is going to fall to the political process. But to go back to something he said at the beginning of the interview, plenty of evidence, he said, that is out there on collusion, although the judgment is no crime. That makes it a political issue. And that, to me, buttresses the case that Jerry Nadler and Adam Schiff, who the president ridiculed, as we played earlier just last night, continue to pursue that for what it probably is always going to be, which is a political conclusion, to make a judgment about whether there were high crimes and misdemeanors and what you do about that and what you do about letting people know about that.
An impeachment?
It's not going to happen. As a practical matter, impeachment was off the table before the Mueller report, to my mind, and Mueller didn't put it back on there. In fact, until or unless we see the full report, we can't make a final judgment, but I think it makes it that much less likely. This is going to be – look, I had a Democrat say to me recently, you know, the Mueller report, the problem that we Democrats had, he said, in the Mueller report is we thought it was our get-out-of-jail-free card. We thought it was going to make everything easy, that we'd find out that the president was a Russian operative and that the American people would insist that he be kicked out of office. Now it's going to be hard. Now it's going to be a campaign. Now they're going to fight it out on the issues. And you know what? Democrats like their chances on those issues.
Yes, they sure do. And I'll say as we discussed, I talked about the Mueller report being anticlimactic on the question of Russian collusion. I will say that as we get as we approach the release of whatever is redacted, it's going to look pretty damning on the question of obstruction. There's no question.
And we know from what Barr said about it that most of the information, but not all of the information about obstruction, has been publicly reported. That means there's new stuff.
And even the most of the information that's been out there, seeing it all, you know, in one place and you know, with one kind of, this is the case for obstruction. There's been a lot where you kind of forget stuff happens and then it moves on. There's been a hell of a lot of smoke on this, and I think that it'll be interesting to watch the president as we get closer to release date. Does he really follow through on his promise to leave it up to Barr and his statements that he'd want this report to be out, or does he do what he did with his promise to testify under oath, which of course he never did? Anyway, that is all the time we have for Powerhouse Politics. It is baseball season again. Let's just close with the thought that Bryce Harper is fill in the blank.
Did himself a lot of damage in that debut, man. That was tough for Nats fans to watch. Hard for Washington to stomach what
Classless.
Bryce did. flipping that bat after a home run when the team is already losing. Yes. You know, this is going to be whining
to the Washington Post about how he wanted to stay with the Nationals.
But, and they're going to play 19 times a year forever. Yeah. Because Bryce's contract's forever. And this is going to be a heck of a rivalry to watch.
I just wish the guy would stop hitting so many home runs. All right, that is all the time we have for Powers Politics. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our entire Powerhouse Politics team, including Trevor Hastings, Angie Yak, Avery Miller. See you again next week.